This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Immigration. Who comes to this country? It's a huge topic in politics and in the media. But when we talk about it, we often focus on one sliver of the issue, illegal immigration. But millions of people are contending every day with the U.S. legal immigration system. Now, many have been living and working in America for years, stuck in residency limbo as they contend with an alphabet soup of visas and green cards and a system congested with red tape and long waits in line. An immigrant from India who applies for a green card today, that's what grants you permanent residency, can expect to wait in line for 50 years. It's a challenge that 1A listener Puneet Chaudhary knows very well. She wrote to 1A on Facebook to ask us to tackle this issue, and she joins me today from WGVU in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's the latest in our series of shows suggested by you, our listeners. Puneet, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you. And thank you for suggesting this topic to us. What have you and your family experienced that made you ask us to talk about legal immigration?
So I'll start by telling you, I came to United States in 2001 to get my doctorate in chemistry. I graduated from University of Texas in Dallas, and I graduated in 2006. I've been here since then. We applied for a green card permanent residency in 2013. My husband's a physician, so we applied through him. I've done different postdocs in this time period, and we thought we were... we wanted to stay here. I want to raise my family here. So we applied for residency, and we're still waiting to be, we're waiting in the queue. We still don't know where we are.
Still don't know where you are. You graduated in 2006. Here we are in 2020. That's, do the quick math, that's 14 years.
Yes.
And you applied, when did you say you applied for permanent, for green card status?
2013.
Okay, so 7 years ago. Can you give me a sense of the process involved here, all of these different steps? What has it been like, whether you want to describe it in terms of paperwork or wait times or both? Give me sort of your eyes into the so-called legal immigration system in the United States and what it means to try to come here.
So... I can give you my my perspective on that is when we applied, because my husband had been serving in an underserved area for, he's a physician, so he'd been working there for all, he did his residency in St. Louis, and then he did his fellowship in Gainesville, Florida, and both of those areas are underserved areas. So we applied in National Interest Waiver, which is specific for people who serve underserved communities in the United States. And because I wasn't working, because I could not work in that time period, because I did not have a visa to work. So I did not apply on my independent status, although I could have if I were working. But because of family issues and all the moves that we had to do, I did not apply on my status. We went through my husband to apply for the green card residency. And it's a lot of paperwork. And it's a big burden of proof to show that we are required, like we're important to the community, we provide a service to the community, and so we've met all those burdens. On my end, I have publications, I have a good record of peer-reviewed publications that I've published on my end, but we do a lot of paperwork, if you want to say that, for applying for this.
And you are able to work now. Clearly, you have publications and you've been published.
Yes, I currently am working on the program that's called H-4 EAD. It's for people whose spouses, who are on H-1, whose spouses are waiting to get their green cards, because it's such a long wait. So in the time period, we had this program that was put in. So I'm currently working on that.
In the time period you wait for a green card, you can work in this country. You came in 2001 as a student. Puneet, what made you decide you wanted to stay after being a student in the United States?
I loved the opportunity that I was offered. So I have a degree in chemistry from India, and I moved, kind of slightly changed my field. So I loved the fact that I wasn't restricted to one field or one choice of area of study. I have now experience in multiple different areas that I was able to gather. And the life that I have here, I was able to get my own car. I got my own house. I was so much more independent than I'd ever been before in my life, make decisions for myself. And that's what I want for my kids, to be able to live in a life where they have choices, they have opportunity, and when they do hard work, they'll actually be able to make something for themselves.
Hmm. Now, you talk about the uncertainty of temporary status, being able to work while you wait for the green card status of your spouse, and all of the different vagaries there. But I understand this kind of really hit home for you in 2014, right? You took a trip north of the border to Canada, but your trip back didn't go so smoothly. What happened?
So we took a spring break. We thought we'd applied for a green card in 2013. So I thought we were great, okay, and it should all be fine. So we went to Toronto to take a spring break. And when we actually went for our visa stamping, my husband, who's on H-1 and I'm H-4, so I'm a dependent. At that time, I was not working. So I didn't think I had any reason to worry. They actually approved his application and they they put me in administrative processing, so I could not come back home with my family.
Well, how long did that take to get resolved?
So it took from the date, it was close to 5 weeks it took for them to resolve this, and I had to stay, I stayed by myself in Canada in that time.
In a motel? What did you do?
I cried a whole lot. I checked the internet because basically I had no place to look at or surf, because there's no website or a place where they tell you this is, or a time frame that they tell you it's going to get done in. So you just basically check and check every day and wait for the answer to come back on if you've been approved or what other process needs to be done.
13 years you'd been in this country, in limbo, of course, as we've mentioned, various kinds of limbo, and 5 weeks in a motel somewhere, Hamilton, Ontario, or wherever it was.
It was in Toronto. Was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
How did that make you feel when that happened?
I did not want to think of what was happening. I prayed every single day that it would be over. I think I was fortunate that when I look back at it, it took 4 weeks, but it was done in 4 weeks, and I didn't have to stay out longer than that, which was very fortunate. The hardest part for me was my girls at that time were little. I had a first grader and a kid who was going to kindergarten, pre-K. And making both of them leave, I think that was the hardest thing I've done so far.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about work, because you came here for an education. You started working after that. I want to ask you about what it's like to find work, to try to work, when you're in limbo. We got this call, though, from Jillian in Philadelphia. Listen.
My husband is an Indian immigrant who came to this country more than 22 years ago, finally securing his green card more than 12 years after he arrived as a result of our marriage. My husband came as a student and, after completing his graduate studies, secured an employment visa. But that said, he often had to bypass promotions and turn down job offers that provided more seniority and higher salary, because it would mean going to the back of the line in the immigration process and securing new sponsorship, which is sometimes expensive, from his new employer. As a result, he sometimes felt trapped in his job because of his immigration status.
Praneet, does Jillian's story sound familiar to you and your job search?
Absolutely. I was nodding my head as I heard that call, because to tell you the truth, I graduated in 2006. I could have gone to work. I had a difficult pregnancy and I could not go to work right away. I found my first postdoc in St. Louis, where my husband was doing his residency. And every single time I go, I have to I was fortunate enough to find employers who would sponsor a visa for me initially. But then after my trip to Toronto, I was so scared to apply for one, because sometimes you have to go out of the country and come back. And I did not want to take the chance where I would be separated from my kids again. So I did not work for a long time. I did not work for close to 5-6 years because I was so scared to even apply for a position. And now I started working last year. I found I'm working on a project for gene therapy for Parkinson's. And I did not mention this, but my visa's up for renewal and we're not sure if it's going to get renewed or not.
Even now, you're not sure if it will be renewed?
No, I'm not. There's no guarantees.
Praneet, This country has afforded you some incredible opportunities. You've mentioned them, a life, a car, a house, a way to raise your family. And at the same time, left you in Canada in a motel for 5 weeks trying to get back in. Do you feel now, so many years later, that you're part of America?
I think so. My community, the people I have around here, the friends that I have, they support me. And so on that, I feel, but it's hard because I have no other rights. I cannot choose a lot of things. I cannot do a lot of things that I would like to do or be capable of doing. Like Jillian mentioned, I have started my career over a third time. I could have been a professor. I could have gotten other jobs. I could have maybe started my own company or discovered something else. But I'm still kind of starting from the bottom because I don't know. So I know I have a place. I think I have a place here, and I want to find my place.
And the rest of us might wonder how we might have benefited if Puneet had been able to pursue one of those other jobs that she started out on before all of her complications. But these issues are complicated. It's not just about the point of view of one person. An Indian national who applies for a green card today can expect to wait in line for 50 years. We're going to talk about why and continue with 1A listener Puneet Chaudhary. I'm Todd Zwillick. We have other journalists and experts here as well. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. This hour is the latest in our series of shows suggested by you, our listeners. And with us today is a 1A listener, Puneet Chaudhary, who suggested we talk about the complex legal immigration processes that have left her and millions of other people waiting in line for years for a green card. We've heard from many, many more of you who are on that waiting list. This message came to us from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
I have been in line for immigration since 2010, and it seems like this process keeps taking forever. I have contributed to this economy since I moved here. I've had jobs. I've worked for large Fortune 500 corporations and small businesses, and it pains me that a place that I want to contribute and live in that makes it so much harder for me to become a contributing member.
We got this tweet from Paula, who said, "I think we can all agree, if we're honest, that if our ancestors had faced our present immigration system, we wouldn't be here." Well, we'd love to hear from you as well. You can comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A, our email address 1A@WAMU.org. I want to bring some other voices into this conversation now. Eleanor Pelta, she is a partner with the law firm Morgan Lewis, specializing in immigration law. Eleanor, thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Also at the table is Abigail Hauslohner. She's an immigration reporter for The Washington Post. By the way, we invited the U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services to participate in today's conversation. They did not make anyone available to us. Eleanor, there are a lot of ways that immigrants enter the country legally, though navigating those is definitely not easy. I think we've already gotten a taste of that. Can you, in broad terms, describe what the ways are? You say they go in two major buckets, right?
That's how I think of it. So in one bucket, we have our temporary immigration system. It's like an alphabet soup of temporary visas, and that's how people come here temporarily and do the kind of work that Puneet and others were talking about when they first come here. They might come on a student visa, they might come on a work visa and work for a U.S. company. And then there's another bucket or broad category of permanent immigration or green card immigration. And that's really divided into three broad subgroups: family-based, employment-based, so you're sponsored by an employer like Puneet's husband, and what I would broadly call humanitarian immigration, and that would include refugees and asylees and some other humanitarian classifications.
Many of those categories that have been in the news and controversial,
right,
at the border. Well, Abigail, I want to zoom in on, they're we could spend not just 1 hour, but six on all of these different aspects of the immigration system. I want to drill down on this one aspect of legal immigration, the green card backlog. What exactly is that? How do people wind up in the backlog?
Well, there are a couple of different backlogs, but today, you know, we're going to look, I think, specifically at the employment-based green card backlog, which is that, you know, there are about 1 million green cards handed out a year by the U.S. government, as in permanent residency. That's the last step before you become a U.S. citizen. And 140,000 of those are employment-based green cards. Now, that means it's cut off at 140,000. But they get way more applicants and way more people approved than the number that are actually handed out. And they are overwhelmingly Indian. In fact, overwhelmingly Indian tech workers. And that is just a reflection of the population of people who are coming over on the certain type of employment visa, the H-1B, that tends to end up getting sponsored by employers for permanent residency and citizenship. And so Not only are, you know, that overwhelming majority, you know, would, you know, you'd think that would translate into an overwhelming majority of Indians getting green cards. And in fact, it is a majority of green cards, or a majority of the employment green cards do go to Indians. However, there is a cap. There's a country per country cap. You can't give one country more than 7% of the employment-based green cards in a year. And so what happens is we've had people, Indians, who are waiting and waiting. There is now a backlog that is an estimated 800,000 people, most of whom are Indian.
And we're going to talk more about that 7% cap. It's highly controversial. Our responses and our Twitter mentions this morning and planning the show prove that it's controversial. We're going to get to that a little bit later in the hour. You talked about the employment-based green card system, 160,000, you said, granted? 140,000. What about family-based green cards? How big is that universe?
So family-based green cards, as Eleanor mentioned, that's the biggest bucket of green cards handed out every year. And there are also backlogs for those. And that also has to do with this per country cap that only applies to certain categories. And so you see backlogs in categories like adult siblings of U.S. citizens. So the, you know, U.S. citizens will apply for their siblings who are, say, Filipino or Mexican or Chinese. And then there is a backlog for certain nationalities. That's also a reflection of the sheer number applying and the limit of what can be handed out. And so for Mexicans, so for example, Mexican siblings, adult siblings of U.S. citizens, right now the backlog for them, the wait time is about 20 years. As in people who are getting, Mexican nationals who are getting their green cards today, who are the sibling of a U.S. citizen, they've been waiting in line for 20 years.
So the wait time from a place like Mexico is decades, far longer. The wait time from a place like Slovakia, much shorter.
That's right. And that's because far fewer people from Slovakia are applying.
Eleanor, you work with companies that want to hire immigrants under the H-1B sponsorship program.
Correct.
And there are other ways as well. What does it look like from the employer side? There's a qualified person from India. We really want them. What do they have to show in either to get this person to the United States versus hiring somebody who grew up around the corner?
Well, to bring somebody in on an H-1B, they basically have to show that the person's going to work in what's called a specialty occupation. And that's an occupation that requires a baccalaureate degree in a specific discipline. So if you're going to be, you know, a data scientist, you have to have the right background or degree or spectrum of degrees to qualify for that job. But you also have to win the H-1B lottery.
Lottery.
So, yes. There are only a total of 85,000 H-1Bs available each fiscal year. It's capped just like the 140,000 cap that Abby was talking about. When there are more applications for those slots than there are available slots, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services conducts a lottery, and they choose 85,000 cases and they adjudicate them.
Puneet, tell me a little bit about your experience navigating the legal immigration system in this way. I mean, look, you have a rich, complex life like all of us. This isn't the only part of your life. You drive a car, you go to the grocery store, you worry about your kids, you scold them when they make a mess, all that stuff. How big a part of your life is all of this, worrying about paperwork and costs and writing checks and calling people like Eleanor, the lawyers?
It's a huge part of what I have to look at and worry about. Like I mentioned, I'm up for renewal for my visa status of H-4 EAD right now, and I haven't heard back. It's been over 5 months, so I don't know. We have to worry and plan accordingly, because it may just happen that I don't get a renewal, then I have to change my life completely again because of that. Then I also, every time... just to get my driver's license renewed, there's a huge amount of paperwork that goes in to prove that I have the required requisite materials and everything. So it's just like simple things, everything. I have to, when I go in for my employment, I have to give my paperwork and show that I'm authorized to work and get things done. It's not it, everywhere I go, I use that.
That's the part of the emotional cost. What about the financial cost? What about all the lawyers? What about the money? Do you have your head around how much all of this costs you every year or over the last 5 years?
It is a significant part, because I think initially when we could have applied earlier for a green card, but we didn't have the financial means to do it at that point. I wouldn't have been able to afford the lawyer fees at that point. So I don't think we went in for that option. And the other part of that equation was, I never thought in my life, because when I talked to people on campus, everywhere you look at my resume, that like you have a doctorate from here, you'll be getting your green card very soon. So I never thought I'd have to worry about this and it would take this long.
Daigo emailed us, I'm originally from Japan and recently became a permanent resident through marriage with a U.S. citizen. There were clerical errors and snafus with my application. The only fixed cost, eventually, $800. I received the green card 16 months after the initial submission, and it cost over $3,500. Eleanor, does that case sound typical? It sounds pretty smooth in his case.
People who are married to U.S. citizens are actually not subject to any quota. So almost a
completely different universe than what we're talking about. Marriage is the key in that case.
Right, except that they are subject to bureaucratic delays, which have increased over the last few years.
All right, we got this message in our inbox from Florida.
I'm an attorney who's dealt with immigration issues. And the bottom line is the immigration system is so broken and so arbitrary that there is no system actually in place. The people that you call in for assistance have no idea where your case is, who's responsible for it, what the next process is. There is no way to find out why your case is approved or denied. There is no way to find out when the next step is going to happen. There is no way to do anything with regard to reasonably processing the case.
Eleanor, that fellow attorney of yours says that the system is a mess to navigate, even for him, a professional. And that's before you get to what obviously must be language barriers for many, many people trying to come here or stay here. Can you give me a sense of what this system is like to navigate?
Well, apart from the problems posed by the quotas, which are really, you know, require legislative fixes, over the past few years, the agency has gotten far more difficult to navigate. It is much more difficult to speak to a human being, to resolve a problem, for a foreign national to make an appointment to go in and meet with someone at a local USCIS office. You practically have to have a dire life and death situation. Anything less than that, it's impossible to speak to someone. So if there is a snafu, if there is a problem, if there's a clerical error that's causing a delay, it's very difficult to get that resolved.
Abigail, we're going to talk more about the backlog delays that are part of just the system, but this is something different. This is just inefficiency, poor design, that old bureaucracy we all like to rail against, and maybe with good reason. The immigration system outside of the actual four corners of the rules sounds like, at least from these anecdotal reports, it is not functioning.
No, it certainly is not. A former former Bush administration official actually recently described it to me as a patchwork quilt of solutions, in that there really hasn't been any meaningful legislation really kind of overhauling or reformatting the immigration system in decades. And that goes for just the green cards as well. Part of the problem I hear from attorneys is that the number of green cards allocated each year simply does not reflect the population, the demand, the economy's needs. The population of the United States and the economy have grown tremendously, in the past three decades, and yet the number of employment-based green cards has not changed since 1990. That was
1990.
The last time it was increased. That's right.
I thought there was always some immigration reform is a piece of political maneuvering that nobody can get their arms around in this environment, and not for the last 15 years, frankly. But I always thought there was the ability to pass little things on H-1Bs, visas, big corporations want them. That's not the case?
Well, what you see, this is where the patchwork quilt comparison comes in, is what has gotten by over the years occasionally are little pieces of legislation that are very narrow and tackle little things, in terms of changing something on H-1Bs, for example, or authorizing, a certain set of visas for this year. But what, attorneys, and I'm sure Eleanor can speak more to this, what I hear from experts is that, together, that does not represent anything comprehensive. In fact, it may just make things even more complicated because there are ripple effects through the system. And if you want, we can get more into H-1Bs because that is a type of visa that ties into this green card backlog that there are, a lot of problems with. You hear all sorts of things about H-1Bs, and there have been various narrow efforts to try sometimes to tackle that over the years. But you can see there is, all of these issues sort of affect each other. And so that's one of the things we hear from lawmakers, too, is you need a comprehensive solution.
You need good luck. I don't mean to sound cynical about it, but I've been on Capitol Hill and was on Capitol Hill for enough iterations of comprehensive immigration reform to have earned a little bit of cynicism on that issue, if you'll allow me to have it. Eleanor, the times when there have been small parochial expansions in work visas or H-1B visas, is that largely because they are pushed by people with access, big corporations who know how to get things done and say, hey, look, we need 1,000 more of these because we need these people in our labs? And
I honestly can't remember the last business immigration fix. And I don't think that the large corporations are having any more success than anyone else. I mean, what's so interesting is that you hear a lot of talk about making our system a merit-based system, but in the employment-based category, it is merit-based. We have subcategories for Nobel Prize winners and other geniuses and people like Puneet, and we have, categories for people with master's degrees. We don't have enough numbers. That's the problem.
The green card backlog. Give me a little bit more view into how big this universe is, how long the waits are from different countries and different groups.
Well, right now, the employment-based green card backlog is estimated to be about 800,000 people. The reason I say estimated is this ties into, again, what one of our callers mentioned, the attorney from Florida, that there's so little transparency in this system. So we don't actually know. The government doesn't tell us how many people are even in the backlog. Why? Because they only count the number of people who have applied, as in the actual workers themselves, but their spouses, their children, they're in the backlog too. We don't know how many they are.
We don't even know how many there are. IT Doc tweeted this. I'm an Indian physician waiting in the green card backlog for more than 8 years. I've been in the United States for 14 years. The worst part is that after being here for so long, if I get disabled or I die, my family, including my children, have to self-deport, and this is the only country they've ever known. Is reform to this system possible? Have we written off Congress? I think I did just a minute ago, but should I have? More from our guests, our experts, and from Puneet, and from you in just a moment. This is 1A. Well, we're talking about what it takes to legally immigrate to and stay in the United States. Here's a message from one of you that landed in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Byron, and I'm calling from Washington State. My wife and I have been living in the United States for the past 5 or 6 years, but unfortunately, it looks like we're going to have to leave our home in the U.S. for Canada in the upcoming month, simply because my employer did not follow through with their pre-hire promises to pursue a green card for me after they hired me away from an employer where I had a clear path. This kind of thing happens all the time in the United States, and I really wish there was a way for me to pursue a green card on my own that was easy, just like there has been for us in Canada. Again, we love America, but the immigration system sure could use a lot of work.
There's Byron with an example of how a broken system has sent him fleeing from this country in a way. And Gretchen emailed this: the United States has a broken Byzantine immigration system, and we wonder why we have so many illegal aliens. We punish the migrants who try to follow the law, and every once in a while give the amnesty to those who broke it. Another testament to the inability of our leaders to reach reform on this issue. There are attempts at reform. I've been dissing Congress pretty hard. There are attempts. A Senate bill 386 would change current law, which limits any country from receiving more than 7% of green cards. Abigail, you mentioned this cap, 7%. And we heard from a lot of people on Twitter about this. This 7% cap and the reform efforts are controversial. Sam tweeted this: S-386 is a racist bill designed to benefit only people from one country. If this bill is passed, it will take more than 12 years for a Harvard graduate to get a green card, while an Indian from unknown university gets a green card. And Maddie tweeted this: there are close to 500,000 people waiting for green cards for decades, while the other country's citizens don't even need to be here to get a green card. This systemic unfairness would be eliminated by S-386. The ones against it are pandering to the alt-right, extreme right. Abigail, what is this debate? Why is it so contentious?
Well, part of the contention arises from the fact that in both of those experiences or opinions that you just heard, there is truth. There is some truth to both of those. And so that is eliminating what S-386 does is it eliminates the per country cap. The reason people are so passionate about this is that eliminating the per country cap would mean that the backlog, the folks who are overwhelmingly Indian, would then be able to collect their employment-based green cards on a first-come, first-served basis. Now, there's a sort of a phase-out provision to that bill that protects other nationalities for a couple of years. But for the most part, analyses of this bill have shown that this could mean basically mostly, if not only, Indians collecting employment-based green cards for anywhere from 7 years to the next 17 years.
Because of the sheer numbers already backlogged and coming here.
That's right.
And maybe that's what led to Atira, who tweeted this: there is a backlog for India caused by H-1B visa abuse and big tech fraud, not by the per-country cap. So obvious that removing the per-country cap in S-386 will not solve the backlog. That bill was created will create a new backlog for the talents from the rest of the world who had no role in creating the issue in the first place, and it's unfair.
Right. Well, the repercussions of, you know, of basically allowing only Indians in for, or rather only Indians to get employment-based green cards for the next, you know, 10, 17, whatever years, means that, you know, the backlog continues. In fact, these analyses say the backlog continues to grow. You know, it could be 1 million people in 10 years' time. And not only that, but while the wait extends, say, to 17 years to get a green card, that means everybody. So it goes from, you know, right now, Indians who have been waiting about 10 years are collecting their green cards. It'll mean everybody, all nationalities, are then waiting 17 years.
What does this accusation of H-1B visa abuse and fraud refer to? What's the thing there?
That person's talking about the H-1B visa system, which is, it's the big work visa. Eleanor can get into this more. Primarily the users, now Puneet's husband has an H-1B, she mentioned. He's a physician, but a lot of the people with H-1Bs are tech workers. And again, a lot of these folks are Indians. The abuse that he's talking about is that there have been serious allegations, you know, and reporting on abuses of this H-1B system by U.S. tech companies over the past, you know, decade or more, really since the big tech boom of the 90s and early aughts. And what you've seen is, what you hear from, say, American workers, is that there's unfair competition because the H-1B process, H-1Bs are being handed out, the allegation goes, too easily. And that because of these wait times, because of the green card, because an Indian tech worker is going to be waiting for a decade or more for a green card, they are then they are here on an H-1B in the meantime, and they are tied to their company. So that means they are limited in the extent that they can get raises. They are limited in the extent that they can change jobs.
They have no leverage in the market.
They have zero leverage. And they also, you know, would expectedly, you know, be feel really tied to whatever their employer wants. In that, you know, I've heard from a lot of Indian workers who feel like they can't really challenge their employer for better, you know, working conditions, for example, because they are dependent on that company to apply for their green card and follow
through. Now, we talk about the need for reform. Zoe Lofgren is a congresswoman who happens to represent California and happens to represent a district pretty tech heavy with a lot of tech companies in her district. Now, she is the author of H.R. 1044. It's the same as S-386, just on the House side. It's the House version. 1A producer Avery Kleiman had a conversation with Zoe Lofgren yesterday to get at this issue of the backlog of the H-1B visas and what she thinks reform should look like.
What about diversity? At least for a little while, this legislation would mean that many more people would be getting green cards from India than from other countries.
We have crafted in such a way that no one who is currently approved for a visa and in the queue would have to wait any longer than they otherwise would have to wait. After that is done, there's a 3-year transition period, making sure that other countries, in addition to India and China, would also receive visas, and ultimately there would be wait times for all nationals, which is not reasonable, but we can't get consensus on whether we've got the appropriate number of green cards allocated. Everyone would have to wait an equivalent amount once the transition period is accomplished.
You represent Silicon Valley, and tech companies lobbied pretty hard for this legislation, and that's because they really stand to benefit. A lot of the people they want to hire and keep in the United States are STEM workers, many of them from India, who have a very long waiting time. Does the whole country benefit from this legislation, or does your district, Silicon Valley, disproportionately benefit?
Let me give you an example out of Silicon Valley. A doctor who I met, this doctor is from India. His wife is also a doctor, also from India. They're the only two doctors in this little town in the Midwest. They have been waiting for 12 years, and there looks like they're going to wait for, they don't even know how long. The children have basically grown up in the United States. They don't know anybody in India. They don't speak a language other than English that's spoken in India. They are about to age out of their dependent visas. These two doctors were going to close their practice and move to Canada. I said, hold on, we're going to try and get a resolution for you. We haven't yet, but ultimately, because they have obligations to their sons and daughters, they'll have to close their practices and move to Canada.
The senators who agreed on a bipartisan version of your bill said they wouldn't put it to a vote because it wouldn't pass. So what happens next for your version?
Well, we had an overwhelmingly positive vote in the House. I wish the Senate would pass it. They've proposed, you know, various tweaks to it, which we are very open to doing. But in the end, the Senate is the Senate. I can't do it for them.
That was 1A producer Avery Kleiman speaking with Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren of Silicon Valley in California. Eleanor Pelta, the congresswoman, says well, this isn't really about big tech. It's not so much about my district. It's really about the people who are a doctor in a rural area. Do you buy that, or is largely the power behind this, to the extent it has any, about big tech?
Well, I do actually agree with what Zoe Lofgren is saying, because that's been my experience as a practitioner as well. I did want to clarify a couple of things. I think that a connection between H-1B alleged fraud and the backlogs is a bit of a red herring. I think the problem with the backlogs is the ridiculously low number of employment-based visas available every fiscal year. And until that gets resolved, the backlogs aren't going to get resolved. And some of the people who are against 386 and 1044 feel that if we don't add additional numbers, all we're doing is rearranging the deck chairs on the proverbial Titanic. But in my view, and when we say Indian tech workers, I want to kind of clarify that a little bit. First of all, Indians are not the only nationality impacted by backlogs. Chinese nationals are impacted by backlogs. And tech workers, let's just say that's a very broad category. I do a lot of work with pharma companies. I see a lot of Indian nationals in that industry as well. They're statisticians, they're data scientists, they're biotechnologists. They're not just computer systems analysts. So we're really looking at a number of industries that can benefit if this is fixed.
Puneet, we are throwing around so many numbers here. 800,000 in the backlog, waits of 20 years or more, HR 1044, S386. You listen to all of these things fly. How does it strike you? Because another thing that you can't do, or at least I presume you can't do in the list of things that are out of reach for you, is voting.
Yes, absolutely. And I would like to thank Eleanor, because what you just pointed out, painting everyone with a broad brush is so wrong. I'm not a tech person. There's teachers, there's physicians, there's nurses, there's we are in all different fields. I don't even work on a computer that much. And we all, and nothing against people from the tech, they offer so much. We've brought in so much advancement to every community and every field that we've touched. So I feel it's so wrong. How does it benefit just that one district if I develop a new program or new technology? I benefit everyone. When I am able to bring in my gene therapy that we're working on for Parkinson's, is it going to only help people in Grand Rapids in Michigan where I am? It's going to help people all over the United States, and not just United States, the world over. How can we lose that competitive edge? It's backwards.
Abigail, I want to make sure that we touch on this issue of children aging out, because IT physician, the doctor who tweeted in before, mentioned that if anything happens to him, that his children would have to leave, or people can age out of this system. What does that look like for dependents of people who are working here under some kind of visa status?
Right. This is where a lot of the passion and emotion comes in, which is that if someone who is in line for an employment-based green card dies, since they are the applicant, their family, so their spouse, their kids, they then lose their spot in line and they are effectively deportable.
And they're not under DACA. The children aren't.
Nope.
No.
No. And that they
because
lose
they came
it.
Here
out.
Legally. They came here legally. They're not.
They came here legally, but their status, their legal status, is tied to the parent, the spouse who applied. So, for example, in Puneet's position, if God forbid something happened to her husband, she would lose her place in the U.S. despite having waited as long as she had, and you see the same thing now with kids. When kids reach 21, if their parents are in the green card backlog, too bad. 21, they age out. That means they are no longer in line with their parents. They are on their own. They are deportable.
They are, Eleanor, they are deportable? Is that a fact of life for them?
They could be deportable if they can't get any other kind of visa status to stay here. You can only get a green card derivatively through your parents if you're under 21 in the employment base.
How often does this happen that a parent dies and the children are 12, 13, in addition to all of their other troubles in life, which are now astronomical, they're deportable?
Well, that may be a more rare instance, but we see people aging out a lot just, you know, by the passage of time before they can get their green cards.
One of the many, many dozens, hundreds of issues in an immigration system that is fundamentally broken, not just illegal immigration that we talk about all the time, and we should, and we will continue having that debate in this country, but the system, the patchwork quilt that we have in place for people who do, as we like, as we're fond of saying, play by the rules and come here legally. In many ways, they confront something that is no easier. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us. A show that was suggested by our listener, Puneet Chaudhary, the 1A listener who gave us this show idea and shared your experiences. Puneet, thank you for coming on and being so open and intimate with us. We really appreciate it.
I am so glad that you've covered this, and I hope there's more awareness. People understand that I'm not taking something from anyone. I want to be a contributing member of this community.
Puneet Chaudhary.
That chance.
Puneet Chaudhary in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I also want to thank Eleanor Pelta, partner at Morgan Lewis, specializing in immigration law. Thank you. And Abigail Hausloner, immigration reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This conversation was part of our listener-generated series of shows. Next week's topic, chosen by you, will be the spread of corporate health care. This program was produced by Avery Kleinman. To learn more about him, you can go to the website, the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for being with us. It's 1A.